From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the state's housing finance agency offers a zero down payment plan for cash-strapped homebuyers. Also today, half of the respondents in a new WBUR poll says that the state is somewhat prepared for a changing climate. But what else could Governor Baker be doing?
We all need to pull together to do the work that's associated with ensuring that we here in the Commonwealth are ready for what will be the very significant changes associated with climate.
Plus, we'll pick apart the legal intricacies in the Stormy Daniels case.
There were three parties to the agreement. Two of the three signed. Mr. Trump did not sign. We believe that that was so that he could later claim deniability. From a legal perspective, we believe she's free to talk.
And this week marks the 15th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We'll listen back to our conversation with the man who provided the moral justification for invasion. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with an offer. How would you like to put zero down on a home? I mean it, zero down and still get the mortgage and the house. Well, that's what the state's Affordable Housing Agency is offering some home buyers. This week, Mass Housing announced its new zero down payment program to help low to middle income buyers who lack the cash to close a deal on a new home. But the question is, how much will it actually help in Greater Boston's red hot housing market? So let's get the view of an independent housing advocate. Tom Callahan is executive director of the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance. That's a Dorchester-based affordable housing advocacy organization, and he joins us in the studio. Tom Callahan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having us.
So just to be clear, you're not with Mass Housing. You're with the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance, separate organizations here. But just tell us briefly, how does Mass Housing's new plan for a zero down payment program, how would it actually work?
So it's available to first-time homebuyers buying a condo or single-family home up to $400,000. They will be eligible to receive down payment assistance of 3%, which is the typical down payment they require for condos and singles. Single families, and that's up to $12,000, obviously, if you do the math. And it's a 1% deferred loan, essentially, that will be repayable not in monthly installments, but at the resale or refinance of the property with a 1%
right.
interest rate.
Okay.
So that's basically how it works.
So the big change here is that in the past, Mass Housing has required people to put 3% down for their assistance in financing.
Right.
Now they're going to say zero down.
Correct.
Okay, great. So, but there's a cap at $400,000 for the value of the home or the condo. And also, homebuyers have to have an annual household income at or below area median income as well.
That's right.
So just, you know, what's your take? I mean, is this going to help people get into homes?
Absolutely. Down payments, accumulating down payments is one of the biggest barriers. It's not the biggest, but it is one of the bigger barriers that we face here in Greater Boston and with first-time homebuyers generally. So it will definitely help people who are struggling with the high rents. Rents are very high in Greater Boston, as people know. So it's hard to save for a down payment. Right now, it's hard to save, period, and saving for a down payment is challenging for lots of millennials and other folks that are in the first-time homebuyer market. So this will definitely assist in getting their foot in the door in terms of the homeownership
right.
market.
But, you know, I come back to the idea that this is capped at homes and condos worth $400,000 or less. That leaves a lot of the market sort of out of reach of this program.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, I mean, are there other ways, other kinds of programs that we should be thinking about in order to sort of give first-time home buyers access to, you know, all those homes out there, and there are so many that are above $400,000.
Right. Yeah, a couple of comments on that. One is it's not yet available to two- and three-family homes, so that's a issue. I think we want to open this. We'd like to see Mass Housing take a further step and say, yeah, we're going to apply this to two- and three-family homes. I think that opens up. It would probably have to raise the purchase price cap too, because those are obviously even more expensive in many areas where because you have rental income coming in, the seller can get even more than $400,000 for two and three family property. But that's one change I think we'd like to see. The other thing is something beyond the scope of what mass housing can do, but it, I think city and state agencies really need to go back to the drawing board and figure out how we can substantially lower the cost of getting into your first home in Massachusetts. And we've looked at programs in San Francisco. There's close-in cities like Cambridge and Somerville have buy-down programs, which is essentially putting in $100,000 or $150,000 and bringing down a $450,000 house to $300,000. And suddenly you open up a range of home buyers who can actually compete for that house. So it's works similarly to these down payment assistance grants. They are deferred loans, but they come from a public agency. So we hope the city of Boston, state of Massachusetts, can look at more of these buy-down programs. There are examples out there, mm-hmm. Cambridge, Somerville, locally. Some of the suburban communities have also experimented with some of these buy-down programs. So I think it's something we have to explore in Boston yeah. and some of the other communities.
You know, I'm seeing here that currently about half of mass housing's borrowers fall between the ages of 26 and 35. It's a really important age in order to sort of get in as a first-time home buyer.
Yep.
Because that's the way it works in America, right? You build your wealth in a sense through your assets, and the earlier you get in, the better. But, I mean, I'm just wondering, it still feels like these are noble and maybe effective attempts for public and quasi-public agencies to battle back what is essentially a market-based problem, right? Like, things are just too expensive for many, many people in Massachusetts, and that's a fundamental disconnect that we don't yet have a solution for.
So these buy-down programs are another, I think an attempt to make the existing homes more affordable. But you raise a good point. We need to build more housing of all types throughout eastern Massachusetts in all communities. I mean, the cities, the suburbs all have to pitch in. We need to be rezoning, upzoning, as they say, areas around transit, other areas where we can build new housing units so that we can it probably won't be enough to bring prices down, but it at least will moderate
stabilize
prices, and that would be long-term good news for first-time home buyers.
Well, in the interim, and every little bit helps, I think. Tom Callahan, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Alliance, a Dorchester-based affordable housing advocacy organization. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, before we head into the break, I have this clarification about a story we brought you yesterday. That was a conversation with Massachusetts State Rep Diana DeZoglio. Now, in 2011, DeZoglio was an aide on Beacon Hill, and she was also the victim of harassment there. She told us yesterday that in 2011 she was fired and was asked by House leadership to sign a non-disclosure agreement in order to collect her severance pay. Now, DeZoglio's story was first reported in Boston media last week when she revealed it on the House floor during a debate over the new anti-sexual harassment bill, a bill being debated by the House. Now, we requested an interview with House Speaker Robert DeLeo yesterday. He wasn't able to join us, but his staff did send us several statements which did not make it onto our air yesterday during the broadcast. So here's excerpts from those statements. They read, quote, "We believe Representative DeZoglio's statements regarding the harassment she experienced in April of 2011 and are deeply troubled by them." The speaker, however, added in another statement that, quote, "DeZoglio's attorney never raised the issue of sexual harassment or inappropriate conduct during the negotiations which led to her termination and severance agreement. While we understand why a victim of such harassment would fear disclosing it, we have to reject any assertion we were aware of it prior to Thursday or that we sought to silence her and or to cover up any harassment with the 2011 agreement." Now, we have much more of the speaker's statement at radioboston.org. Plus, go there to hear our conversation with State Rep Diana DeZoglio as well. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, I want to play you a couple of seconds from last night's installment of the ever more bizarre Stormy Daniels story. It happened on CNN with Anderson Cooper. Michael Avenatti, attorney for Stormy Daniels, the porn star, and David Schwartz, attorney for Michael Cohen, who is President Trump's longtime personal lawyer. Well, the two men traded insults for almost half an hour. Here's a distillation of that, care of the Washington Post.
All right, you're gonna go down in flames on this case. There's no question about it. 8.6 of the agreement specifically required all parties to sign the agreement.
And or.
I didn't interrupt you during your bombastic comments. Please let me finish.
If Michael Cohen is such a stand-up guy, where is he?
No.
Where is this guy? Why won't he come
come.
Why won't he come and say?
So I hope you have a good malpractice policy, because when she owes $20 million, she should go after you.
And it goes on and on and on. But there actually are real legal issues underlying the bombast and the back and forth that we're hearing on television over this story. And joining us now to make sense of it is retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
Let's not get in an Avenatti-Schwartz type fight, okay? Tell me here. I mean, the basic legal issue right now, I think, is Stormy Daniels is saying that President Trump did not sign.
Right.
The NDA
right.
That she says has prevented her from speaking, and so she should be able to speak. What do you think?
Well, you have to look at the language of the document. The language of the document, if it was signed by a representative of Trump, that may well be enough. And the question is whether or not Michael Cohen, acting for a company that he formed moments before the money was paid, is sufficient to bind Donald Trump. It's a very legal, technical question about the language of the agreement and whether or not Trump was an essential signer to it.
Okay.
Now it's.
Does it matter that he was listed under an alias in the NDA?
It really doesn't matter whether it's listed as an alias. I mean, the question really is whether the language of the agreement says. And it's very hard to figure out the language of the agreement from the back and forth of these lawyers. I mean, on the one hand, there were things that Trump and Trump alone could do, and therefore no one else could bind him to do it, which suggested then that he needed to sign it. On the other hand, if it was just, you don't tell your story, Stormy, then that may be a different matter. But there was a non-disparagement, which was personal to Trump, and there were other terms of the agreement. So it's a legal and technical argument as to what the language of the agreement was.
Yeah, but of course, this legal and technical argument has to do with the President of the United States and an affair that a porn star said she had with him.
Well, but that's...
And who was paid $130,000 to not talk about.
Right, but let's sort of go up a little 20,000 feet. On the one hand, it matters what the truth of the legal issues are. But from the Clinton administration, Paula Jones case, if the Stormy Daniels case survives a motion to dismiss, if it remains in play, the president can be deposed. That is to say, they can take the president's deposition.
Uh-huh.
So there's an issue of, would a judge dismiss this on the grounds that, in fact, the president hadn't signed it? Would the judge believe that the language of the agreement requires testimony? Sometimes an agreement is not so clear and its intention has to require other people to testify. And if that's so, then there would be depositions of the president, which the Paula Jones case made appropriate.
So we have a precedent here for the deposing of a president. Okay, I got it.
A better way to put it is to take the deposition of, not deposing of the president.
Okay,
under these circumstances.
Oh,
okay.
Good point.
Right, that's right.
Thank you for the semantic clarification.
Right, and in
excellent
fact,
point.
In fact, in one of the three cases, there's an interesting question. What is, if I were a betting person, would one of the three cases, that is to say, Stormy Daniels or the woman whose last name is McDougal, who was paid by
the National Enquirer
to not tell her story, or whether or not some Reservos, who's the woman who claimed that she was sexually assaulted by Trump, if any of these cases make it to the next stage, which is to say survive a motion to dismiss Sumner Servos already has survived a motion to dismiss, which means the case can proceed.
Yeah.
The case proceeding means that the plaintiff moves to take the deposition of the President of the United States, and the Paula Jones case is the precedent for that being allowed.
Okay, so let me just ask you a quick question about the Karen McDougal case, just for folks who have been successfully avoiding the more salacious side of the current administration.
Are you going to talk dirty on public
radio? No, this is a family show, and okay. I'm only presenting the facts here. Karen McDougal is a former Playboy model who claims that she met the president or met Trump at the Playboy Mansion before he was president and had an affair with him in 2006 and 2007. Now, the National Enquirer had her sign a non-disclosure agreement, and she's suing the owner of the Enquirer to get out of that because she said she was duped into the agreement by the tabloid. She says the Enquirer is trying to protect the president because they had a story from her and they ended up not publishing it. But my question, my legal question for you, Judge Gertner, is, I mean, she's claiming that she entered a contract under false pretenses. I mean, is that grounds for nullification?
Actually, again, I need to see the contract, and that hasn't been easy to obtain. But she actually has a more substantial claim. She says there are representations that were made to her in signing this contract, and the representations were false. Representations made to her about that essentially this would be a story, that they were paying for her story, and the representations turned out to be false. Now, if it didn't happen because they just didn't have space for it, it would be one thing. But if it were false because at the time she signed it, National Enquirer knew it would never, mm-hmm. and never play this story, never use this story. Then there's a misrepresentation at the time she signed it. She also makes an accusation that the lawyer who was representing her was in touch, was colluding with the National Enquirer, and that in addition, that the lawyer that was representing her, after she told her story to the National Enquirer in exchange for the money, that the lawyer then. Sent that story to Trump. So she has two kinds of things. She has two kinds of issues here. One was that the National Enquirer and the company that publishes it misrepresented to her about the nature of the agreement. Yep. And the second is that her lawyer was, in fact, working for the defendants in that case rather than working for her benefit. Yeah. She may have an easier claim to undo than Stormy Daniels. Right.
Wow.
But the Stormy Daniels claim depends upon the language of the agreement, which I haven't seen.
Well, I have to say, regardless of the fiery television that's coming up around these stories, there are real legal questions here at play and a lot at stake. So retired federal judge Nancy Gertner and WBR's legal analyst, thank you so much for lending some gravitas to this moment. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Fifteen years ago this week, the United States launched the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
The start of the campaign called Shock and Awe, the original anticipation. Over the next 24 to 48 hours, perhaps as many as 3,000 Tomahawk cruise missiles. It's now approximately 8:18 in the evening in Baghdad, in this part of the world. Listen to this, Jamie. These are shots being fired now in Baghdad. I want our viewers to listen in.
That was CNN's coverage of the so-called Shock and Awe campaign in Baghdad, March 2003. Now, the administration of President George W. Bush justified the invasion by insisting on two things, both of which were not true. One, that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. And two, that the U.S. would be greeted as liberators by the Iraqi people. Well, that moral justification for war was provided most powerfully by Kanaan Makiya. He's now professor emeritus of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University. The Baghdad-born intellectual's books, Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Silence, were deeply influential on U.S. policymakers before the Iraq War. Makiya directly met with members of the Pentagon, the State Department, and President George W. Bush. He contributed governance plans to the State Department's 2003 Future of Iraq project. But of course, Iraq fell quickly into chaos after the initial U.S. invasion. Nevertheless, toward the end of 2003, Kanaan Makiya went on Charlie Rose and continued to justify the war.
Tell me where we are in your judgment.
Well, we're actually not doing nearly as bad as things look on the surface, in my judgment.
In reality, Iraq went from bad to worse to an outright catastrophe. It cost the U.S. more than $2 trillion. More than 4,000 U.S. soldiers were killed. More than 1 million Iraqis were also killed, according to credible estimates. And that shining beacon of Arab democracy that Kanan Makiya had hoped for, well, that failed to materialize. So what responsibility does he bear for that, for providing a moral justification for a failed war? Well, Makiya finally grappled with that question more than a decade later in his novel, The Rope. It is a work of fiction, but it is also something of an apology. I spoke with Kanan Makiya in 2016, and I began by asking him, exactly whom was he apologizing to?
People of Iraq, the Shiite community into which I was born, and all those Iraqis who used to follow my writings and my various and sundry appearances over the years. And that's important because I am not saying, if I may be absolutely clear, that I would do anything other than support a war to overthrow that particular dictatorship, namely the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. To be honest with you, Magna, I wouldn't know how to do anything else. The be-all and end-all of my life was certainly not to promote a war, but it was to write about dictatorship. I mean, nearly a third of my life has been spent doing that. And I became so convinced of the criminality of that particular regime, I was utterly convinced, and still am today, that its removal by any means necessary, I might add, was a moral thing to do. Think of a Syrian person today whose family are sitting in Aleppo with barrel bombs being dropped on their heads by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And you will understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, but I mean, speaking of Syria, though, I mean, many people, many analysts would say that the quagmire of Syria and the ongoing nature of it is directly related to the catastrophe in Iraq.
I don't agree. The state of Arab affairs, if I might say so, the very fact that Syria fell apart, that Libya is falling apart, that Yemen, one country after another, is falling apart, indicates that what went wrong is not caused by the 2003
war. Well, let me clarify then. The international community's either response or lack of response, depending on your point of view. That's
yes.
What people point to Iraq as being a major influencing factor.
I realize that, but I think that's an immoral and indefensible position when hundreds of thousands of people are being killed in a matter of a very short period of time and when absolutely no future and no end to this seemingly intractable conflict appears before our eyes. So the question is what it is that one is pushing for. The issue of Syria is not just ISIS. ISIS is slowly being shrunk down on all sides, and I think ISIS will, in a period of time, disappear. But the problem is what will replace ISIS? And here we get to the real roots of what went wrong in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That is the failure of the Arab state system, if I might put it that way. We're witnessing a failure that's decades in the making, and we need to understand it as such in order to even think about where we go from here.
Well, so you have written before that Iraqi mistakes are orders of magnitude more important to understand what went wrong in Iraq than American mistakes.
I absolutely true, and I think that's the reason I wrote the book the way I did. If you notice, although it tells a story between 2003 and 2006, it tells an Iraqi story. And it truly is an all-Iraqi story. Deliberately, the Americans are there in the background, the helicopters hovering up and scene descriptions here and there. They make the odd decision here and there, which influence some of the characters in the novel. But all the actors are American, are Iraqi, and that is how it should be. And the point underlying that is that when you look at what really went wrong in 2003, it's not that the Americans didn't do 101 things wrong, of course. Massive mistakes that have been very well written about by others. Tons of excellent books exist on the errors that the Americans made. But the principal errors for why we are in the state we are today in a country like Iraq were made by Iraqi actors empowered, to be sure, by the American war, but nonetheless actors who had made choices that were the wrong choices, in my opinion. Other choices could have been made that have brought the country to its knees in the way that they have. And that's what my book is about.
You center the book around two deaths.
Correct.
One of them is the manner in which Saddam Hussein himself was executed. And why do that?
Well, that was such a revealing moment. The ugliness with which he was essentially hanged. It wasn't really a hanging. It was a lynching more than anything else. And so I set the scene for what had become, so to speak, of Iraqi politics by 2006, 3 years after the war. Just about when the civil war inside Baghdad was getting underway, with that experience. And it's partly because I myself was physically sick after I learned the full details on the very day it happened, and the little video clip that was circulated over the internet was shown. I couldn't get out of bed for a couple of days. I was so disgusted. I was so absolutely revolted. So that makes an appearance. And incidentally, that part of the book is as – part one of the book is as – factual as I knew how to make it to be. I mean, I imagine his feelings. I imagine certain things, I suppose. But I didn't at all flinch a budge from an attempt to be as factual as I possibly could.
So let me ask you. The book has been reviewed, and you yourself say that your novel is an indictment of the Iraqi ruling elite and its failures after the 2003 war invasion. But I have to ask you, there was ample evidence before the U.S. invasion that such an outcome might come to pass. I mean, I was looking at a 2002 Boston Globe article where you yourself said that you think there's less than a 5% chance that what I'd like to see happens actually happens. But it seems to be an obligation, the invasion, even if it's only a 5% chance to make it happen. And then, I was looking at, for example, George Packer, writer for The New Yorker, who you know very well, who in 2003, just 17 days before the invasion began, said that the closer we get to war, the harder it is to believe that the liberal democracy Kanan Makiya envisions will ever be the outcome. People had misgivings about the capacity of the ruling elite to govern before we even began shock and awe.
They had doubts about its ability to deliver a democracy, a liberal democracy.
But that was what was being sold to the American people to justify the war.
That's what George Bush sold the American public to. Weapons of mass destruction actually was the main sort of bill of sale. I never bought into that. I never thought weapons of mass destruction, whether he had them or not, was the main issue. Mind you, I thought he had them. In that, I was wrong, as so many people were. But I didn't think that was the reason to go to war. The issue for me, the be-all and end-all of my life, has been the issue of dictatorship. That dictatorship, and this is an extreme form of dictatorship. It's probably the Arab world's most extreme dictator. That for me was non-negotiable. The dictator had to go. Now, I thought there was a slim chance, and I thought it was the obligation of people like me to make that transition into the 5%, 10% that you mentioned,
but
namely towards democracy.
So let me ask you, because again, I don't, as you said earlier, whether or not to go to war is a separate question, but studying why the aftermath happened in the way that it did is of profound interest, because, you know, it was what, your 1993 book, Cruelty and Silence? I mean, you were already expressing very reasoned and passionate doubts about the Arab intelligentsia.
True.
And, but it was you know, a faction of that same intelligentsia that was told to go and take Iraq into an era of democracy.
But I felt, and I still think it's true, as an activist. Now, I wear two hats, I mean, like all of us do in life. On the one hand, the professional hat, I'm a writer. I do my best to tell the things as I see them. On the other hand, I was an activist for the removal of that particular dictator, Saddam Hussein. And in my activist hat, I know the world and options are full of choices. People, men, and they were, alas, mostly men who came to power in the post-2003, make choices. And they need not have made those choices. They could have made other choices. Now, you may say there's a slim chance that they would make the right choices, as I did, and as you quoted me, but it's still my obligation, I think it's even a moral obligation, to press for the successful coming to being of those choices, however slim the chance may be. Think of the American Revolution. What were the chances of defeating the British and establishing the kind of constitution, the kind of republic that the United States became? Slim at the very outset. But men took the chance. They opted, so to speak, on the basis of on the basis of what was the least likely thing to happen. And I think that was the right thing to
do. More than 4,500 Americans have died. More than 165,000 Iraqis have been killed since 2003. I mean, what does the 5% chance mean to the survivors of those killed?
The 5% is what I would work towards. And my chances of, it's not the reason for going to war. The overthrow of the dictator, the beginning of a new life. Remember what Iraq was like on the eve of 2003. Under sanctions that had utterly decapitated the middle class, sanctions that had probably done more to damage the country than either the 2003 war or the 1990 war, one war that preceded. Iraq was in an impossible situation. If with that particular dictator in power, no hope for the future existed. So the beginning of hope, and hope is a complicated and difficult thing, the beginning of hope, I gambled on hope, and I think that was the right thing to do. I mean, think of the title of President Obama's book.
The Audacity of Hope.
That's exactly. I dared to bet on hope, and I would do it again.
You know, in the book, I get the sense that, you very directly ask about, you question yourself about where you went wrong in your thinking. I wonder if writing this novel is it Kanaan Mekia sort of grappling with it sounds like maybe not, because you just said that you still dare to hope, but I wonder, I mean, does that genuinely continue to be true?
I have demons inside me like everybody else, I'm sure, and perhaps I am doing that.
Kanaan Mekia, there's one last thing I want to ask you. I mean, the reason why you wrote this book and the things you're thinking matters because you did have a front row seat to the decision-making process in the run-up to the Iraq War, and that you did have connections with the people making the decisions about what would happen after. Dexter Filkins, in 2007 of the New York Times, he wrote this about you. He says, "It seems Mekia's heart, his passion to destroy Hussein, his passion to bring freedom to Iraq, does not want him to go where his intellect would take him." And he describes you as a man of very high intellect. He says, "You exposed a terrible dictatorship, and for the noblest of motives, you signed on to an invasion that ended in catastrophe. You misjudged your native country and your adopted one, too."
I didn't misjudge large numbers of people. I misjudged the leaders who came to power in the immediate post 2003 time. I knew those men. I worked with those men. But in the end of the day, I was not a member of any particular party or organization. I was a writer. And while people may have listened or may have read my pieces, nobody went to war. The United States certainly did not go to war because Kanaan Mekia asked it to. So, I mean, one should be humble as to one's ability to influence such things. The United States is a great big power. It does what it does for its own reasons. I made my voice clear. Dictatorship, the be-all and end-all of my life, the struggle against dictatorship, that was for me important, still is important, not just in Iraq but in Syria, and I still stand by that.
Kanaan Mekia. He's professor emeritus of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University. We spoke with him in 2016. This week marks the 15th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, let's just check in on the weather because we've got another storm set to hit tonight, the fourth nor'easter of the season. And joining us now is WBUR's meteorologist David Epstein. He's with us via Skype. Hello, David.
Hello, Meghna.
All right, so what's in the forecast?
Well, we've got the precipitation now breaking out across the south coast. So the good news for those folks headed home out of Boston, if you're headed north or west, no real weather problems. There could be a little bit of precipitation beginning here towards the end of the commute. But basically, this is a good situation because most of the snow falls overnight tonight. Generally, I'm looking at 5 to as much as 9 inches around and south of Boston as you get north, 2 to 5 inches. So the Pike about, and again, you know, you got to give me a little leeway on these things, is about the 2 to 5 inch zone. So the further north you get, certainly there's going to be less. So that 5 inch amount should be somewhere along the Mass Pike. And then as you get south of the Mass Pike, we'll start moving upward. The most snow may fall in a line from Providence over to Plymouth and down through the canal in that little zone right there, just because temperatures will be cold enough for snow. And then as you get to the Outer Cape, it'll be a little too warm, so they'll have less snow.
Well, any concern about power outages, coastal flooding? We've seen that in the past couple storms.
We've got some minor coastal flooding, definitely likely during the time of high tide, which occurs at about 3 o'clock, give or take an hour tomorrow morning, depending on your favorite beach. So there will be some minor to moderate coastal flooding. But again, we're not looking at a major situation here. In terms of power outages, winds are going to be quite gusty along the coastline, mostly southeastern Mass, but even from Boston up through Gloucester, Cape Ann, and as you move up towards Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in that area, winds will be gusting over 30. With the heavy wet nature of the snow, there can be some scattered power outages, but hopefully we're going to stay under the threshold to really have widespread power outages. There may be pockets down towards interior southeastern Mass, just to the west of Route 2, where we see the most snow and the wet snow and the wind, and that's where I think we're most vulnerable for those power outages.
Well, WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. David, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Have a good afternoon.
Okay, and as we mentioned, this is the fourth nor'easter of the season. So, of course, I mean, the question is always, is this going to be normal? Is this the new normal for us? Lots of crazy weather with a changing climate. Well, on that point, Governor Charlie Baker, in fact, is embarking on a new climate resiliency initiative, beginning with a $1.4 billion bond bill. He announced the initiative last week in Scituate.
I have to say how important it is that we get folks from all 351 cities and towns to understand and appreciate that this is an issue that's fundamental to them as well as fundamental to us, and that we all need to pull together to do the work that's associated with ensuring that we here in the Commonwealth are ready.
Well, according to a new WBUR poll, it actually shouldn't be all that hard to get people on board because climate change is a big issue here, with over two-thirds of likely Massachusetts voters responding to the poll saying we are already seeing the effects of climate change. So let's explore a little bit about how we can take that political attention and transform it into political action. And to help us answer that question is David Cash. He's dean of the UMass Boston McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies and also the former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. Dean Cash, it's good to see you again.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Meghna.
Okay, so let's first of all start with this $1.4 billion bond bill that the governor has put forth. Good idea?
Very good idea. Very positive initiative. This is an area in terms of resilience and preparation for climate that we should be investing in. This kind of investment will help us deal with the kind of new normal that you were talking about.
Right. So we're seeing, what, $170 million to repair dams and seawalls, almost $300 million for grants and funding for environment-related community projects, $270 million on supporting state environmental programs. So sort of a lot of an infusion of cash in a lot of important places.
Yes, which is also very important. And what has to begin, though, are really good analysis of where those investments can best pay off and provide the best kind of investments for future impacts.
Yeah. You know, this is an election year that we're coming into. So some of the Democratic candidates who are going to be challenging Governor Baker are saying, yeah, bond bill is great, but really we ought to have a permanent new revenue stream to help with climate resiliency.
So I think the ability to afford the kind of investments that we're doing is something that we should be thinking about. Should be thinking about what are the right kind of mechanisms to finance these kinds of things. In some ways, preparing for climate, the impacts of climate change require very different kinds of financing than the support of solar and wind and storage, because those are all marketable right now. So the call for looking at how we invest and create the kinds of revenue streams is something incredibly critical right now. And the results of Katrina and Sandy show us some indication of how those investments can be created through revenue streams.
Okay, so when we talk about resiliency, though, I mean, it's a very broad brush, right? Because it's everything from seawalls to thinking about moving towards more renewable sources of energy, mm-hmm. right?
So and about asthma, how do we protect for that, for flooding that is interior, not by the coast? There are many, many aspects of climate change that are going to influence our how we deal with multiple different stresses.
Okay, so I bring that up because the Environmental League of Massachusetts actually gave the Baker administration a C on its overall, on the administration's overall performance last year in leading on the environment and energy. ELM was citing budget cuts and staff reductions to environmental state agencies and what they see as Baker administration policies that support, you know, natural gas pipelines. I mean, is that a fair take on the governor's leadership on the environment?
I think when we look at the administration, there's no question that the Baker administration has moved forward in a lot of different ways. In fact, several months ago, you and I sat in this room and talked about how the Trump administration was pulling out of or mm-hmm. beginning to pull out of the Paris Agreement. And the Baker administration, as the Patrick administration before that, and in fact, the Romney administration before that, has moved the ball forward on the clean energy agenda. And this latest bill, I think, does the same thing on resilience and adaptation. Very few states are taking these kinds of steps. So I'm not, although I am in education, I am not in the business of giving grades on this. I could say that in many respects, the Baker administration is moving forward very positively. And there are some areas that can use a lot more attention. Transportation, for example, being one of those.
Right. Okay. So Elizabeth Turnbull Henry, who's the president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts, is supportive of this bond bill. But looking more broadly at state leadership on the environment, she says she believes there's some gaps in the fundamentals, such as zoning laws. Mm-hmm. Let's listen. Mm-hmm.
We keep building in vulnerable, flood-prone areas and building buildings that are not necessarily resilient or energy efficient. So if zoning codes represent these blueprints for communities and building codes are blueprints for structures, neither are keeping pace with the changes that we need.
Now, this was to the point you were making earlier that, like, we were talking about resiliency. This is a very broad brush, mm-hmm. and there are some key changes that we could be made that it doesn't seem like are coming anytime soon in Massachusetts.
I think that she's making a really good point here. Now, much of this zoning is done through municipal actions, and one of the key points that's coming out of this legislation is providing the kind of resources that municipalities might need to study what are the better kind of zoning codes, both on the efficiency side and on the resilience side. And in fact, I've been part of, at UMass Boston, we have an organization called the Sustainable Solutions Lab, which this spring will be coming out with a study that looks at both financing and governance on how we can better prepare.
Okay, so we've just got about 30 seconds here left, Dean Cash. I mean, to that point, I think people right now are looking at the seaport as exhibit A in maybe how not to develop in the face of a changing climate. I mean, mm-hmm. what lessons can we draw from the fact the seaport's been flooded multiple times already this year?
Yeah, I think the lessons are obvious. We're looking at a place where 10, 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't the analysis or the understanding of what the impacts would be. We have a better understanding now. And our planning and our zoning and all the kinds of rules and regulations that we have should be analyzed and acted upon, given that we know that there's going to be severe climate impacts in the future.
Yeah. Well, David Cash is the dean of the UMass Boston McCormick's Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies and also former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. Dean Cash, it's always great to have you. Thank you so very
Thank
much.
You. Thank you. Great to be here, Meghna.
Well, since it's Wednesday, let's connect with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, it's great to talk with you.
Great to be back, Meghna.
Well, it's March Madness time, so let's talk about NCAA basketball and all the strange upsets that have been going on. I'm looking at number 16, UMBC. First of all,
don't laugh
I'm
when you
sorry,
say
but
that.
Who
they
is
won.
UMBC?
University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Wow, the Retrievers, right?
Many people now know that who didn't know it before round one of this NCAA tournament.
Well, aside from the fact that they have a cool mascot, they also beat number one seed, the University of Virginia.
They did indeed, and beat them convincingly after it being close at the half. So it's probably a good thing that a 16 finally beat a 1 on the men's side, not by a point, not by a bad call by a ref, but convincingly.
By so, what, 20 points?
A lot of points. And so that was a good thing. I'm very happy about this because I will never again have to hear a sports writer or a columnist or a commentator say, it's never happened that a number 16 is knocked off. And the problem is that none of them remember that it had happened before when the Harvard women's team knocked off Stanford. And The Harvard women were a 16 seed and Stanford was several years ago. Stanford was a number one. And it did happen, but Everybody conveniently forgets that. And now it's happened on the men's side as well, and more power to them.
Well, I appreciate that nod to women's basketball, Bill.
There'll be more.
I do. But let's listen to a little bit of the Retrievers themselves. This is Nolan Garrity, Max Portman, and a few more of the Retrievers talking about their victory with reporters. They're in the locker room after the game.
Yeah, we're a really relaxed team. You know, we're not just happy to be here. Like, we're happy to be here and have fun, but we know we're here to win and stuff. So
relaxed at halftime. And
relaxed, but serious.
Relaxed all the time, but yes, definitely serious.
All right, so big question is, what do you guys know about Kansas State?
Nothing.
We have a better percentage of winning that game than we just did this game. So that's all we need.
I love their spirit because they ended up getting beaten by Kansas.
They did indeed, but it wasn't a humiliation. 50-43.
Okay.
In no way a lopsided win. And they do seem to have had a lot of fun and to have taken the tournament in stride.
Well, care to peer into your crystal ball, Bill, and tell me if you have any predictions for championship game?
All right. Here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to say there have been a number of upsets already, not just the big one that we just talked about with a 16 beating one.
Oh, is that all that wailing and gnashing of teeth is? All those brackets being busted.
They're all broken. They're all broken. Nobody has good brackets anymore. There are two number one seeds left on the men's side of the tournament, Kansas and Villanova. And I'm going to say, just for the sake of saying it, we're going to see a reverse in form. And one of those number one teams is going to win the tournament. There'll be more upsets going forward, but one of those number one teams is going to win. That's as far as I'll go.
Okay. Well, I you know what? I'm gonna say I'm with you on that, because when all else fails, put your money behind a number one.
Go with the chalk.
All right. Well, let's move on to hockey now, because the Boston Bruins have signed a new player. He's Harvard junior Ryan Donato, And that deal was inked over the weekend after the Crimson were bounced from the ECAC tournament. Now, Donato wasted no time. He scored his first goal with the Bruins on Monday.
Wenberg runs out of room because Carlo makes the check. Donato two on two. The trailer crew back to Donato. He scores! Ryan Donato's first goal as a Boston Bruin.
Nice job, Donato. What do you make of the rookie?
Well, new name to the Bruins in one sense, although his dad has a Bruins pedigree as well, and not a new name to followers of hockey in New England. Donato's a big name down the years, and of course, this kid was very successful at Harvard before joining the Bruins. I love the idea that he has talked about trying to finish his junior year. As a student at Harvard, just as the Bruins go off on a 10-day road trip, he must think that he has some very understanding professors.
Maybe he does.
It's
a hard thing to do.
I mean, a lot of I know some women hockey players who have been at places like Harvard, been at Harvard, and taken time off to play in the Olympics or to play in the World Championship for their national team, whether they're Canadian or U.S. or whatever. And then they come back after that's over, and it takes them 5 or 6 years to graduate from college instead of the standard four. But what I heard was that Donato's going to try and be a student and a Bruin at the same time. That'll be an interesting challenge, I would think. No, I can't imagine. I think his senior year will probably be put on hold. Maybe he'll come back to school in the summer and take it bit by bit, but we'll see. We'll see.
Okay, I'm going to be a little hard-nosed on this one. I mean, it's good that he's trying to finish his junior year now, but Mr. Donato, you got to go all the way. Like maybe if it, like Bill, like you said, if it takes 5 or 6 years, that's fine.
That's the way it should work, isn't
it? But you got to be a Harvard graduate
as well as
a high-scoring Bruin.
You want to have that pedigree.
It's so easy for me to say that here from the cushy confines of this armchair versus being out on the ice. Okay, well, let's move on. One last little wonderful hockey story here, because we want to give a quick shout out to Waltham High School boys hockey team. They are Massachusetts' new state champs. They won the Division I title on Sunday with a 4-1 victory, and they're getting some kind of parade.
What could be better than a parade down Moody Street?
Nothing.
I love it.
That's fantastic.
Small-town America.
And the parade's going to include the girls team as well.
They got the Good Sportsmanship Award, and good on them for both teams being honored, because that is precisely the way it should be.
And absolutely. And Moody Street's got some great restaurants,
too. It does. So. They could stop and have Indian food, Greek food, Thai food, everything there.
Go Waltham. All right. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., and he graces us with his presence here at Radio Boston on Wednesdays. Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Megan.
And Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Ellison Bruzek, with help from Zoe Mitchell and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow. This is Radio Boston.